Well, hello there, fellow Cantabrigians and other world travelers. This is Robert Winters, and we're on Cambridge Inside Out.
Is that where we are?
Yes. and tonight's co-host is the inimitable Mr. Patrick Barrett.
And my hair.
And denizen of Central Square. Yes. Aren't we all? All right. Actually, a few things probably worth mentioning off the bat, whatever the hell that means. Actually, what does that mean? I don't even know. So today is September 6th, 2022. I think I got that right. And that's actually significant for at least two very big reasons. One is it's primary election day in Massachusetts. So I voted, as I like to, I sent a word around to a lot of people. I'm one of the 97 people who haven't missed a citywide election since 1997. So
is Governor Healey allowing early voting? I thought she got rid of that.
She's pre-qualified for governor even before the election. There we go.
Is anybody else running? It's just.
Right. Well, you know, I'm focus often on elections and, you know, help, you know, doing things like candidate pages in municipal election years. I have to say that primary election days in Massachusetts to me are bordering on depressing because first off, there's not very much selection. Right. Sometimes there's no selection. And so oftentimes when there's a choice between no candidate and the one candidate is running, I choose none. For example, for my state rep.
But, I do a little thing where I just write in Tim Toomey.
You know, that's okay. I like that too. You know, maybe I should have done that today, but I blanked a few, and the ones who are running unopposed, I only vote for the ones who I actually know personally and like, you know,
who's running unopposed?
Well, Sal DiDomenico, for the state Senate, at least in my district, which may be the same as your district. Peter Katujian is the sheriff, who I think is a good man, a really good man. You know, he does some really, really great things, helped us out a lot with the Middlesex Canal Association and getting prisoners to actually help trail clearance, which they loved. So we appreciated it. The prisoners appreciated it. And Peter Katujian made it happen. So good for him. So anyway, so today was election day, and I think polls are open till 8. So if you haven't voted yet, we're also obliged to tell people to go run to the polls, right? The drop boxes were, as has become the norm in the last few years since we've had this process. They're very underutilized until about the last day, in which case everybody comes piling in and stuffing those ballot boxes. And the election commissioners have to multiple times a day empty them out and bring the ballots indoors, and get them ready. So anyway, when I went to vote today, you can see the poll workers were processing all of those mailed-in ballots. You know, I think when I went in, I was the only person there other than the staff people.
So a lot to process in and of itself, though, you know.
Yeah. So anyway, so it'll be over later today, and we already probably, well, actually there were a few races, you know, like lieutenant governor and I guess the attorney general's one where a race where the results are, you know, it's anybody's guess how it'll work out. But honestly, none of these things are of any great consequence to me. I don't really need the attorney general tomorrow. Thank you very much. So anyway, the other big thing about today is that it was the first official day of our new city manager, Yan Huang.
All right.
And, he's been in a sense on the job for quite a while, because even as Owen O'Riordan has been the acting city manager.
Thank you, Owen.
And Owen did a great job, and, you know, and he's a good man. And, I was hearing stories all over the place of the new city manager visiting city departments, getting to know all the various city employees, getting to, you know, take care of things. I probably the most interesting story of all I heard was one person down in, I guess it was the Department of Human Services Programs, who mentioned that there was, you know, when speaking with the new city manager, saying, oh yeah, we've got this, people are selecting these programs, but you know, it's, they're oversubscribed and there are a lot of people unhappy with the selection, you know, and maybe we could do something like that. And the new city manager says something, you know, love Louis DePasquale's and his predecessors to death, but they said, send me the data. You know, the notion we have a city manager will say, send me the data, I'd like to look at it. You know, that's a pretty big departure, you know, from the way things have been for a long, long time. So I thought that's it.
I'm hoping that it's a send me the data, but I'm also going to look at the issue itself. I'm a little bit concerned that we do have these wide pendulum swings from, you know, gut feelings to, you know, I will only look at numbers, and then we wind up with, you know, still not a good result. But I actually am cautiously optimistic.
Yeah, I'm cautiously optimistic as well. I mean, you know, he seems like a very personal gentleman. And, you know, and most everybody, if not everybody I know who's had interactions with him, have said positive things so far. So, you know, let's hope for the best, you know. By the way, they haven't, thankfully, City Council hasn't met since August 1st, which for me is nice because I get a little weary of it at times, but they are going to be back in action, whatever that means, next week on Monday. So
can they stay on vacation? I just want
to. You know, there was a day I used to really look forward to going to city council meetings instead of, you know, following the process and whatever. But there did come kind of a point of just a few years ago where I actually found it to be kind of a net negative to actually be there. I didn't like the tone of things. I didn't like the one-upmanship. Let's introduce city council orders just so we can sort of stand out and get attention, as opposed to get stuff done.
What drives me nuts is the, you know, in some cases the very lengthy public comment section, of which I often, you know, at least more so than not, participate in. And it really goes to like these stump speeches and talking points. And a lot of these activist groups, who are really the only ones who show up now, have the same talking points that have been scripted for them. And it's, you know, corresponds to whatever councillor's pushing what issue. It seems like bad local theater.
I think that's pretty close to my estimate as well, you know, and it doesn't have to be that way. And, you know, I don't know, maybe, especially with, you know, now that some of them have, you know, they've walked the path a while, maybe there'll be a little bit of a shift. We'll see. And, you know, come the end of this year, they'll have to start thinking about things like re-election, and that'll, I don't know if that'll make things better or worse, quite honestly.
I don't know if they ever stop thinking about re-election. I wonder, given the current topics that we have before the council, whether it's Buda, whether it's incentive zoning, you know, the bike lanes that were kind of a settled issue at this point, even though unsettled amongst some of the population, it's been a wacky couple of years, limited participation, this weird switch to Zoom, and the council's done a ton of stuff that, and I think in a normal time, would be tricky and would also be much more contentious. And I think I think the public is about a year and a half behind the council right now. And I think that to me is the biggest problem.
Yeah. Actually, just one thing relating to something you said there was that, you know, there's the pros and cons of doing business in Zoom, to be sure. But one of the things that I know has actually created a kind of a special problematic aspect to the whole bike lane discussion was how a lot of the changes were all happening a little bit sort of behind the insulation of Zoom and online meetings, so that there was not as the same sense of sort of upfront public information as might have been had it not been done.
It's amazing how 15 bodies in the Sullivan Chamber can change the course of a discussion, and Zoom eradicates that.
That's right. And that was definitely the problem, you know, or at least a problem. But, you know, we'll see how it goes. You know, I think maybe even the bloom is off the rose of Zoom meetings. I mean, it was a good novelty for a while, but a lot of us are getting a little weary of that too. So
I couldn't possibly hate it more.
Right. Of course, we are doing this in Zoom right now, so I guess
I miss being able to reach next here and just to grab on to your kids.
That's right. Pass me a beer. Here we go. Right. And just very, very briefly, you know, our COVID numbers have been reasonably good lately. Good numbers came out here today. And for those, I think right now the BA5 variant is now 99.8% of all cases around here. And for those who are concerned or older, like me, the new bivalent vaccine should be really available really, really soon. So I think I'm going to cautiously say we're in a reasonably good place here.
So. I have to admit, I used to follow these numbers every single day religiously for like almost 2 years. I've completely stopped. I think for my own health, so I'm not entirely focused on the up and the down, because I think we were on a bit of a wild ride for a long time, where we'd have like in the summertime, June would be good, July would tick up, we'd say, oh my God, we got to run for the hills. And then like, you know, you can't live that way. And I wouldn't advise people to, you know, to do it on a daily basis, but you know, there's things you can do to keep cautious. But I'm also not a doctor, which is another thing. I've retired from being a online epidemiologist. I think it's important for people to make their own decisions.
Well, at the risk of shooting off into a computer graphic, which may not be viewable just depending on how Zoom treats it, I'm going to actually do just a little quick shot over here, just as a little reminder of the sort of the general profile and way the cases are going, which is that they're not disappearing. They've kind of gone off from peaks. You know, there was large peaks, a more recent peak, and then they're pretty much sort of just, you know, just puttering out. You know, it's
kind of amazing to think that, like, you know, we're like in a zone where we're at a higher peak than we were when this first hit.
That's really true.
And like, I mean, I'll tell my grandkids about it, because they'll be asking, like, just the effect that had for that time period. Like, holy shit.
Right. Well, the main thing to really everybody has to keep in mind is that, knock wood, right? But the fatalities have really been under control. We are pretty well vaccinated around here. The effects have been relatively mild in these more recent variants. And I think July 14th was the last fatality. So please don't change, you know. But, you know, so these are,
Have you had it?
Not that I'm aware of. You know, I've had a lot of people around me have gone through it, and it's like I'm feeling like, well, why not me? Why am I being left out here? You know,
the only reason why I ask, and I know obviously you didn't have to answer that, HIPAA, I don't want to violate HIPAA, but I think it's, you know, it used to be like not people didn't talk about it because they felt like they had done something wrong or done something bad, and I think that has changed a lot too. I think people are coming to realize that like it's not your fault if you get it. My family and I got it in April, and I only took a test because my son had an exposure, and I was like, I was positive. Like, oh my God, I had felt nothing. But my wife felt was quite sick, you know? So I think it's just
a little bit. I don't know the proper definition of the word endemic, but I think maybe that's kind of what we're at now, where we're at right now, right?
Again, I retired from online epidemiology. I'm also no longer an online physician. So, it's just a thing that I think we're definitely in a different place. I can see that with people going out. Central Square is a buzz. People are going to restaurants, having a good time. The 907 Main, the hotel there, we're at occupancies that I expected, actually I never really expected to see. So I think people are out and about.
It's some of the improvising of outdoor sidewalk patios and stuff that we're all done in the height of 2020 have now become sort of normalized. Yep. So, you know, a good thing grows out of a bad thing. And, I think we'll see what happens when the winter comes again, but Central Square is very, as a business, you know, in spite of all the usual challenges, it's actually been economically getting pretty, it's sort of heading toward healthy. again.
Yeah, I mean, so we have a lot of businesses that are carrying an enormous amount of debt from either SBA loans or other types of debt they had to carry to get through the pandemic. Some relief was given, but as people know, that the Restaurant Revitalization Fund did not come to Central Square, came to about two or three restaurants, one of which closed. So a lot of these guys, myself included, really took on an enormous amount of debt to survive this. So things like those patios, I think those are interventions that seem like, well, I think some people have said, well, the pandemic's over, we don't need these anymore. It's not over for us. It's not over for the businesses. We have a long ways to go before we dig ourselves out of that hole.
You know, there's an aspect of that whole phenomenon that is reminiscent to me of the way it used to work, maybe still works within Cambridge Public Schools, in that once upon a time, if you were sort of in with the in crowd and you kind of knew how to work the system, whatever, you could somehow manage to get your kids into whatever programs you wanted. I mean, I'm not accusing anybody, but it just seemed to work out that way.
Right.
And those who didn't know how to kind of work the system or have the inside track were often left out. And, you know, when you ended up with these big schism in the various school programs as a result, and I don't know, it was like every 5 or 10 years, the school committee would have to reinvent the school system to try and address this inevitable reality. But maybe it is an inevitable reality that people who just know how to work the system know how to get the benefits. And I think that's exactly what was happening with all this relief funds.
One thing I saw was, especially in the school system, that sports participation is way, way down. And they're trying to do some outreach to increase that. I wasn't sure if it was a result of, you know, in some cases, I believe the school system still has it that if you're not fully vaccinated, you can't participate in sports. And I wasn't sure if that was having a negative side effect. I certainly don't think that rule should be in place anymore, but that may be contributing to it. But
I did hear some word today, and of course today was also first full day back in school for the Cambridge Public Schools, I believe.
Yeah.
That, you know, most of the hard, difficult rules have been relaxed now. And I hope that that extends to things like school sports, you know. So we'll see, right? You know, so actually one other topic, and this is something I could certainly go on with for ages, but you can definitely do a better job than I, had to do with something we talked about when you were last on this program, which was about incentive zoning.
Speaking of the Sullivan Chamber.
Right.
Incentive zoning, which there is a hearing tomorrow at 3 p.m. in the Sullivan Chamber, although most likely on Zoom, because I went to the first ordinance committee hearing on this, and it was only me and a man named John sitting side by side alone with no counselors or anybody else. Kind of felt eerie to talk about incentive zoning.
You know, let's be clear what incentives are. Some people just use the word linkage because fundamentally that's the vehicle that through which money comes through for this, right? But, you know, the city is obliged to do what they would call nexus studies in order to show some sort of relationship between commercial development, I believe, non-residential development, and its impact on housing locally, whatever. I think that was sort of the basic idea.
Yep.
And this was originally rooted in about mid to late 1980s. And there was, they didn't do any changes in the linkage rates or the fees that were being charged until just a few years ago. And now at least some are wanting to jack the rates up significantly right now, again.
About 40%. So, I think the confusing piece is people think this is because we have all these labs coming in, they're bringing in high net worth workers, they're buying up housing and pushing people out. But this is not how linkage is calculated, nor is it how it is applied. What linkage, the methodology for linkage, which thank goodness it's being sort of fleshed out in these conversations and people are saying, what the hell, is that the way that currently CDD does this is that if you have a use that would more than likely have people of lesser means associated with it, like a restaurant, you wouldn't have someone working in a restaurant typically that makes $200,000 like they work doing a lab, that those people more than likely will need assistance for housing. Therefore, their nexus study, the way that they've have it set up and the way it's always been set up, is that if I was to build a 50,000 square foot restaurant, that restaurant would have more of an impact on housing than a lab of the same size, which I have a serious question about, because I think what's being fleshed out in these conversations, and I think the council is sort of like, you know, we have a new council every 2 years ish. A lot of those people don't know why this exists or how it came to be. And the planning board was the same way. When they asked these questions, which they, you know, they continued their hearing, they were saying, we had no idea this is how it was set up. And the way my argument right now is, and this is where I want to get to, is that this, the way our zoning is currently drafted, the way we've set up linkage fees, it is 100% pushing lab only developments in the city. That if you're building a commercial building, 94% of the time, based on their own Nexus study, it's going to be a lab. And the reason for that is that lab uses command a much higher rent. They are seen as a much more valuable, much more stable use, and therefore much more financeable by banks, and come at a much higher assessed valuation. So anybody who's looking at Planet Cambridge, trying to figure out how to make something work, a lab is always going to be the only answer. And my problem with that, Robert, I love labs. Labs are great. They gave us vaccines. They might make it so I can smoke cigarettes again. We're all praying. But I don't want to live in a city that's only labs. And I think that if our mentality is labs or affordable housing, because that's what the promise is, right? It makes for a very dull and poorly planned city.
So let me look back and then forward on this here. So I'm just going to speculate here now and say back in the 1980s, their logic was likely that if you were going to be building some sort of, you know, high-end thing, then those people who work there would be living out in Lexington and commuting in here because that's what they would want to do. But then in the intervening 30, 40 years, there has been a huge change, so that it is far, far, far more likely that if a person wants to actually work in a lab environment or other high tech, what we used to call a high tech job in Kendall Square, let's say, it is more likely they will look to buy or rent property in Cambridge now. And that's a big change from where it was back 40 years ago, 35, 40
cool,
years
man.
Ago.
Cool, man. People want to live in the city. They want to live close to everything. They want to, you know, that's, you know, you have all these people moving into the city, then all of a sudden you have all these bike lanes, just like they're,
there you go.
It's all like right. Suburban neighborhoods. Right. But which I think, honestly, I don't mind that, because there's an environmental piece of it. And like, you know, we can fight about how they're implemented or where they go. But the issue is, like, you have people coming who are moving into these houses in these neighborhoods. People like me, although I don't work in a lab, but like I look very different than what you'd see in my neighborhood 40, 50 years ago. In terms of economic status. And that's what's driving up housing. That's what's driving up costs. That's what's driving up rents. Not the restaurant that I built on the first floor of the hotel is not driving up rents.
Exactly right. So the logic that was perhaps accurate 35, 40 years ago needs to be revisited, I think, to understand.
That's my only point. And I think their mentality, if it's not broke, don't fix it, but it's broken. And right. It really is broken. And I think the problem is on the political will spectrum, our council doesn't really have much of that. They see as touching incentive zoning as really touching a third rail.
Well, I think they just see incentive zoning as yet just another revenue source to fund subsidized housing. And they're not really thinking of it from a planning point of view at all anymore. It's just a cash cow.
It's a cash cow. And it's also very short-sighted, because incentive zoning is not the only thing that drives up or pays for affordable housing, and certainly isn't the only area of cash that we have to allocate for this. But because a lot of the voters and a lot of the activists, really only, there are only two kinds of activists, like the bicycle people and the affordable housing people. And they push this conversation, and they don't really fully understand development or planning, even though they all seem to have planning degree somehow. It's just, in my opinion, you can achieve the same goal by making some amendments to this incentive zoning, but changing it from $21 to $33, which they're currently contemplating, is a massive mistake and will only yield less. And fortunately, I've got a great story that just popped up just the other day in Porter Square, where you have a building that, you know, people are complaining about, and it's a lab. And you know, they're saying, why isn't it affordable housing and why isn't it mixed use? Because it, no one can afford to build that. No one's going to pay $33.34 to build a mixed use building over 30,000 square feet in the city of Cambridge. It's impossible unless I'm adding a lab to that. And then they say, well, the Cambridge Side Gallery is building affordable housing. They're building only 100% affordable housing. Yeah, because they attached it to a 600,000 square foot lab. So like, I'm getting frustrated because it's,
right. The affordable housing one for the ones down in Galleria was really more of a bargaining chip. It's almost like
you could have gotten 600 units if you wanted. You could have gotten 9. You could have gotten 1,000 units. Wouldn't matter.
Right. I will pay you this in exchange for quid pro quo.
You let me build a lab on 907 Main site. A 40,000 square foot lab is valued at 3 times what my hotel is valued at. 3 times.
Right. Right.
And if I have to bring investors in, they're going to say, hey, Patrick, we know you like Central Square, but hey, you know, we don't live in Central Square. And, you know, why? Let's go build a lab instead. I have people calling me all the time to activate whatever's in my zoning brain to help them put all kinds of labs all over the city. And it's like the gold rush, you know?
Right. So
what I'm begging the council to do is to put the brakes on this. There's no money on the table for any new projects that are coming in vis-a-vis incentive, and to cobble together a better system that allows for the Central Square Cultural District to add theaters and music venues and a hotel or restaurants and stuff that we need to activate that square, to activate that cultural district before they shut the door forever. Because when this passes, you're not going to get another project in Central Square that revitalizes a dying music venue, or that, you know, takes into consideration perhaps maybe bringing a Starlight type venue into that area. No one can afford to do it. And that's that afford to do it part. I'm getting a little frustrated. It's something that councilors Zondervan and Aram Farouk have told many people many times, that this is a de minimis piece of the equation.
But it's
not. In most cases, it's about 9 to 10% of the overall budget.
We're actually down to our last 10 seconds for this little segment here, but we'll pick up a little bit about on this in a few minutes here on Cambridge Inside Out.